Just don't cast him as Mr. Fantastic. In honor of the gentleman and the new Batman movie filming, what do you wish next for Colin Farrell?
I'm getting rich, and I want him to let himself be really hot on camera again. He's still young and gorgeous, and he just keeps playing weird roles, which I like. But let yourself be hot, Colin.
What is his hottest role?
Oh, that's a good question.
Think about it, and then come back to
the end. It's going to be one of his bad middle aughts movies. I'll get back to
it. Yeah, think about that at the end of this lightning round question, which is very speedy. I'm Matt Patches. I'm going to say, come back to those wizard movies, Harry. He's not Harry Potter, but he was in those wizard movies. Yeah.
He does Harry Potter.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, and I'm going to say he should get a streaming deal where he gets to produce movies with bizarre parts for himself.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I would love Colin Farrell's next job to be as my baby's nanny.
You've seen a nanny, don't you?
I need a nanny. I think it would be excellent if it were Colin Farrell, and even more excellent somehow if it were Colin Farrell being my baby's nanny for free.
Did Colin Farrell play like the dad in one of these kind of magical nanny Mary Poppins-ish knockoffs? That seems like a role that he would play, where like he's the dad who needs help taking care of his kids.
My actual suggestion, not that I was at all kidding about wanting Colin Farrell to look after my kid for no money, is that he take on a Stephen Dorff-like role for Sofia Coppola in one of her new movies.
Ooh.
I think that is the right vibe for him at this particular semi-washed state in his career. Katie, what were you going to say?
I was going to pick this movie he was in, this Irish movie called Ondine that I saw, I think, at the Tribeca Festival,
yeah.
Where he plays a dad in need of help who's a fisherman and has this like sexy like mid-90s grunge hair.
Also, I realize that's his hottest. What I'm thinking of, he was in Saving Mr. Banks. Holy shit, that movie exists.
But wasn't he playing her dad?
Her dad, but he was in the orbit of Mary Poppins, and I think I'm just connecting dots. I'm dreaming up a better movie than Saving Mr.
What
Banks.
What a mean thing to do to Colin Farrell to bring up Saving Mr. Banks.
Was he hot in that movie?
I don't know. Maybe? I don't remember.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 285, and it is the week of Wednesday, January 22nd. That is the week that in 1953, The Crucible by Arthur Miller premiered. That was a day.
Yeah.
A lot going on back then.
My name, it was my name, right? That's the one.
I saw Tituba with the devil. Is that a quote?
I remember it. Yeah.
Yes.
You guys remember The Crucible better than I do.
There was a movie.
There was a Saoirse Ronan play.
Yeah, I wish I'd seen it.
I had to watch a lot in eighth grade.
I'm still kicking myself about not seeing Saoirse Ronan in Ivo Van Hove's The Crucible.
The Crucible is probably a play you could do as a movie again in these times, right? There's something to that. The witch hunt, you know? Is Saoirse Ronan as Trump?
God. Okay. We're going to get started. David and Patches are both on their way to Sundance, and I don't know, the altitude's already getting to your brains.
That is right.
While we're all together, David, I hear we have reviews.
We do. We have two reviews that I believe we did not read on last week's episode. I think at least one of them came in after we recorded. But they're both short, and they leave us wanting more. More from you all out there. So please leave us reviews. I'll issue another reminder when we're done here. Oscar Watcher Abby says, great. But Oscar Watcher Abby's review scale, great must be 4 stars because there's a 5th star that is conspicuously empty. And quickly scanning over the text of their review, I think I might understand why. Great, they say. But please don't let Patches and Dave do the podcast by themselves anymore.
I can understand that based on the name of the iTunes account. Probably
sure.
Jumping over here from Little Gold Men or something and
sure,
finding...
Are you saying it's my fault that the Oscar Watcher Abby didn't link the...
To be fair... That episode that Dave and I just did is about the Golden Globes. We broke it down. I don't know what more you want.
It's
about the reunification of Germany, ostensibly. Okay, so that review very helpful for letting us know what at least one listener needs for a five-star episode. Katie and I will endeavor to make sure that never happens again. Spotty track record with just Patches and Dave, but we'll see how it goes in the future.
But the show's still here, at least.
The show's still here. And a good thing that it is, at least according to In the Cabbage Patch, whose review is titled, whose five-star review, I should say, is titled In Defense of Patches. After the libelous reviews last episode, libelous, I feel like I need to step in and say, colon, Matt Patches is amazing, period. Everyone on this show needs to listen to him and watch the comedy. What do you mean everyone on this show? We've all seen the comedy.
We've all talked about it on the episode. Have I ever seen the comedy?
Everyone listening to this show in the Cabbage Patch should listen to him and watch the comedy. Amen. And seriously, for the love of all that's holy and good, watch Under the Silver Lake. The three other hosts, or the other three hosts, are great as well, and I'm always switching between everyone on who's my favorite. It's worth following them on Twitter to read slash listen to whatever else they put out. Please watch Under the Silver Lake, you hooligans. Congrats on being a new parent, David. Why, thank you. I really appreciate that. I have seen Under the Silver Lake. And you know what? I have to say, despite the reputation that movie has since acquired as being somewhat toxic, misogynistic, and so on, even though it did not, you know, knock my socks off the one and only time I saw it, it certainly seems like the kind of movie that would be worth revisiting down the line. And I think of the nude owl lady, at least on a semi-regular basis. So that's something. Katie,
I thought
you
were going to compliment me.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen Under the Silver Lake.
Patch is fine. Dave, you've definitely seen Under the Silver Lake.
No, not yet.
What?
No. But I want
that
to.
That does seem like something you would.
There are definitely email chains from like over the summer where I'm badgering all of you to watch this movie.
That's true. I came really close to seeing Under the Silver Lake, and then I didn't. I don't remember why.
Come on, Dave. It's about the Snyder Cut.
Okay, that's my New Year's resolution. This year, 2020, I will watch Under the Silver Lake.
This review was helpful for getting Dave to watch Under the Silver Lake, a movie that seems...
I'll take that.
At least in its construction and the way that it buries its codes and mysteries, tailor-made for Dave. So thank you for that. Thank you for listening. Please, please, please leave us a review on iTunes. We will read it aloud on the show, good, bad, or somewhere in between. Thank you. Fighting in the War Room on iTunes. Thank you.
So it appears that I am the only person who watched all the SAG Awards, professional obligations, and also, I don't know. I'm
like,
not
in the
when
world.
Were they on?
Yeah, I was the only player. Well, then everyone saw the picture of Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston, so
definitely.
Don't you wish you'd been there
definitely.
When it began?
Again. I don't know. From what I watched of that and many other award shows this season, it does seem an almost unfathomable feat that one person, whether in person or on television or streaming or whatever, could actually sit there and watch one of these things from start to finish. So it would not be insane to me that you were the only one who was able to do it.
I'm a superhuman. It's fine. So at the beginning of the night, they have the relevant cast from all the nominees for Best Ensemble Film come out and introduce their films. And when the cast of Parasite came out and did it, they got a standing ovation from the crowd, which had this very like weird, like, and almost felt like patronizing, like, wow, you came all the way from this other country where you don't even speak English and you're here. And it was, but it was also felt like genuine enthusiasm, which if you, you know, have talked to people about Parasite, we've talked about it on the show, like there's a lot of enthusiasm for this movie. And then it seemed to be much more genuine at the end when they won the Best Ensemble Prize, which I think is the first foreign language film to win the Best Ensemble.
I believe that's right.
SAG Awards haven't been around that long. And it was amazing. And we don't have to talk about it in terms of Oscar buzz. Like I have a whole other podcast that's about that, but we're all psyched about this, right?
Well, let me ask you this to delve a little bit into the award stuff, but maybe from a more 30,000-foot view of it that you wouldn't get into your other podcast called Little Gold Men, which you can subscribe to.
Yeah.
How can they win the SAG Award? You know, it's funny. All of these award shows have really arcane rules about foreign stuff. Like, I don't think Bong Joon-ho could win WGA award, right?
No, he's nominated because he's
really
he made movies for Netflix and whoever put out Snowpiercer.
Okay, so that's what I'm trying to figure out. It doesn't matter that it's not American because sometimes WGA stuff gets weird that it's not like foreign films cannot win the WGA award. So it doesn't matter with the SAGs if you are, if it's a Korean film in this case, obviously.
I don't know. I'm looking very quickly at the SAG award, the SAG membership. I feel like there might be affiliated organizations. So maybe there's a Korean version of SAG that they, you know, take credentials from. I have no idea.
Thanks to the film The Interview, now they are one organization.
I gotta say, I just rewatched Parasite, and this totally deserves the Ensemble Award. This is like watching Ocean's 11.
Yeah, no, this was kind of so exciting about this, is like the SAG Ensemble Prize can, like, you know, sometimes they're trying to predict Best Picture, so they give it to, like,
I hope they are.
Three Billboards, you know, or something that, like, doesn't feel as much like an ensemble movie. Last year they gave it to Black Panther, which was awesome. And it's another movie where they have, like, so many people working in tandem together. But Parasite, like, it's like a play. Like, all of those people are working together to make that movie happen.
Yeah, it would be hard to single out a single person for like, a lead actor award in this movie. Which, I know. Oh, sorry.
Well, no, I was going to say, like, it's a delicate point, and one that I am glad you brought up, because you don't want to diminish from, I think, a lot of the prejudice you get in the Academy Awards, which Bong Joon-ho would be the first to tell you are a local award, is interested in announcing the winning one. But that you don't want to take away from the fact that foreign language films, Asian films in particular, are regularly snubbed in the acting categories, even when they're nominated for larger collective prizes. That, you know, all these Asian films that have been nominated for Best Picture over the years, not that there are all that many, have received zero acting award nominations, because there is a prejudice against that. And that is something that I don't want to dismiss when I underline Patch's point in saying that it may have been hard to single out just one performance from this ensemble, because it is such a coherent instrument, a symphony sort of playing together. Song Kang-ho is excellent and maybe the most recognizable face in the film, but there, you know, one part doesn't really function without the other. They're all they're all submitted to Bong Joon-ho's vision, which is carefully controlled from pre-production. It's difficult for one part to be sort of out of sync with another or dissonant. So you can make the case that that was partially responsible for why none of the individual actors were nominated, but I don't want to take away from the other less generous interpretations.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to speak to that, we were doing some digging at Polya recently and stumbled into these skincare ads that are running in Korea right now. I mean, it's very hard for me to tell how big Parasite is in Korea, and if we have listeners out there who could relay the
phenomenon. It was
a huge box office hit. Yeah, I know it's huge, but I'd love to know about the like cultural impact or how deep it's cutting there in Korea, because obviously it's a phenomenon here, and that's a huge, being a crossover, that's
yeah,
something.
Like, is Parasite like a Black Panther size hit, or is it like a Parasite in the US size hit? Is that like that's the idea? Basically.
Exactly. And we stumbled upon these skincare ads starring Park Myung-hoon, who plays the spoiler alert for the movie a little bit, but he's the husband in the basement. And the guy who's locked up. So what is he on the call sheet, like 9th or 10th? And he's doing ads in Korea right now for skincare stuff, playing his character from Parasite.
What?
Which I guess is a testament to how ensemble-y this movie is and how everyone's getting their day and like every piece of it is beloved. That guy's a star.
The fact that he's doing it in character is amazing.
Yeah, it's the ads are amazing. But yeah, I rewatched the film the other day and it's just a balancing act, right? In the beginning, it's really the son's movie. I think the actor's name is Choi Woo-shik, and he gets the bookends. He's the one who initiates the plan, and the daughter has obviously kind of gone viral for doing her little memorization song.
Jessica, only child, Illinois, Chicago.
Oh wow, you have it memorized. Okay, you have it memorized. Wow.
Yeah. I've
impressed.
Seen the gifts.
And that just is such a sticking point. But her performance is like Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11, like slick and charming and such a hoot. And I couldn't get enough of this movie watching it a second time when I knew all the reveals that were coming and I could go more into the kind of nuanced, just the way that they live in poverty, I think is a spectacle to itself. These performances are dug deep. Just as kind of highly calibrated as the production design, you know, if that was built from the ground up, these characters feel that way too, in a way that I don't think any of the movies I rewatched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood again recently, a movie that really knocked me out the second time, even more than when I saw in theaters. And I think those performances are great, but there's no character or no characters this as deep as the ones in Parasite this year.
What else?
Yes.
The rare dead air on this four-person podcast. I mean, I think it's incredibly exciting. One, because it might actually give Jeff Wells a fatal heart attack at one of these days, which, of course, is the end goal of any award season campaign. But I think that it is what Katie was saying earlier about how potentially patronizing it seemed to give that standing ovation for these foreigners to sort of clap their way through any sort of language barrier does speak to a really sad legacy of how we ghettoize international and foreign language films in this country. No disrespect or diminishment to Parasite whatsoever, a film that was number two on my list of films for last year and that I love very much. But it's going to be really mind-blowing for so many people in the Hollywood establishment when they realize that there are other Korean films, even other films from countries that are not Korea at all, neither of the Koreas, and that they have let get by them over the years that were, if not necessarily always as timely and urgent as Parasite is, or as broadly accessible, no less brilliant and important in their own ways. And, you know, my real hope, as much as I would love absolutely nothing more than to see Bong Joon-ho and his wonderful translator, who has become a star in her own right and is a filmmaker, an aspiring filmmaker anyway, and the rest of the cast take the stage at the Oscars and win Best Picture, I would love for, and I don't necessarily see this happening, but I would really love for this to pave the way for a more normalized appreciation for foreign films. The Oscars are a local award show. Bong Joon-ho absolutely nailed it. They are biased towards celebrating their friends, patting each other on the back. That is the nature of the game. And that, I don't think that if for all the attention that we pay the Oscars, I don't think that any of us necessarily see them as the ultimate arbiter of what cinema is. I mean, even though it's a much smaller field, I put more weight behind even something like the Palme d'Or, just because I think it reflects the slightly broader breadth of what filmmaking can do and what the world is producing. But there really isn't one award that is able to put its definitive stamp on this thing. But if the Oscars, given how influential they are, and given how fucking insane their best foreign language film category is, could do something to make the film world feel more inclusive, not just by diversifying the race of the actors and so on who are nominated, although they absolutely need to do that, and not only continue to diversify the members of the Academy, but also just to expand their horizons of what they consider to be part of this film industry, I think would be really helpful.
It's a big, it's a high hope.
It is, but Parasite, I mean, listen, it always feels like something is going to make history and then it happens and you don't know. Moonlight winning was a watershed moment, and it certainly changed the industry in some ways, but its effect on the Oscars, which are not necessarily the best arbiter of change. I mean, I think that, it's a lot easier. The Oscars are not a useful way of measuring the impact that Moonlight's crossover success really had, but, I think it's entirely possible that Parasite could win Best Picture, and then life goes back to normal, and there's no breakthrough foreign film next year, and we're back to 1918 winning Best Picture, whatever the fuck comes down the pike. But I think that, listen, nothing happens until nothing happens, to quote a sign about addiction that I just got from an episode of Sex Education that I was watching on Netflix, a really, really lovely show that I hope gets a third season. But that's neither here nor there. There cannot be change until there is change. So if we can kill two birds with one stone and have the best of the nominated movies win Best Picture and also push forward in the hope for broadening what the Academy stands for and invites into its tent, then great.
Bring on Adam McKay's version of Parasite.
Please do not. Kill it with fire. Thank you.
Just like turns to the screen and is like, here's why I need my family to structure this scam.
I'm here. I'm going to put down that the TV version of Parasite, if it ever happens, will be fine. That's my bold claim.
I'm sure it will be fine. All TV is fine.
It'll be fine.
I just think it's funny that...
Just a reminder that no adaptation of anything can ruin the thing that already exists. Nothing can ruin Parasite.
It's true, although we learned with Star Wars that sequels can ruin their predecessors. Or not ruin, but diminish, tarnish in some way.
That's true.
I mean...
They can taint.
Litigated
they can taint. They can taint.
Ghostbusters answer the call.
They taint.
Can
they taint.
Taint. However,
taint. Taint.
It's funny that fucking Adam McKay
stop
is
saying
like
taint.
Least taint. Adam McKay is the least like qualified person to pick up the torch that Parasite leaves behind. I mean, he's the opposite, I think, of everything that Parasite does so well. But whatever, we'll save this for a future thing if and when the unlikely event, whatever they're talking about, actually materializes.
Talked a lot, now he has to talk about Bad Boys.
Oh.
Bad Boys, wait. Bad Boys.
All right, let's
what
start
you gonna
we
do?
We ain't going nowhere. We ain't going nowhere because we're bad boys for life.
But I know that I'm not the only one who talked about Bad Boys, so I don't need to who saw Bad Boys, so I don't need to monologue. But I did see Bad Boys. I saw it at the Bad Boys for Life, which inexplicably is the name of the third movie in this franchise, even though Bad Boys for Life is sitting right there. And yes,
no, that's for the fourth movie.
Well, I spent this entire movie thinking like, okay, they're very consciously wrapping up this trilogy, and then record scratch, freeze frame, this is how we obviously have Bad Boys 4. It really bends over backwards to tee that up, but there's even a post-credit scene. It's a lot, but I saw this movie in Times Square. I sat one row behind a man who had clearly soiled himself just before the movie started. Shout out to the two women behind me who shouted about 15 minutes into the movie, "It smells of death in here," which I appreciate. And yet, the highest compliment I can pay to Bad Boys for Life, nobody left that theater. We all,
no matter how shitty it smelled.
Oh God, it only got worse because the like heat was cranked all the way up, and we were just baking in it. But
I mean, it takes place in Miami. It's 4DX, baby.
Yeah,
it smells like shit. It's 100 degrees.
I did miss the operatic quality that Michael Bay brings along with a lot of lesser.
This is not an action movie.
Yeah, I know, but I just like the way he's really at the height of his powers for better and often for worse in Bad Boys 2, and it's a hard
grotesque film.
Michael Bay in that mode, and the directors of this movie don't necessarily try, and I did miss that, but I did really appreciate what they did with the story. Patches, what did they do with this franchise? Tell us.
They did Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for these two schmoes who probably should not be in action movies anymore. And Martin Lawrence gets it, and Will Smith doesn't. And mostly it's dragging Will Smith for pretending to be an action hero in the year 2020, because he's a 50-something-year-old man, and he really can't run around very fast anymore. He's not good at stunts. He does not look cool. He does not make this look cool.
You're telling me the Gemini Man lied to me?
No, Gemini Man told you exactly the truth by putting it in 120 frames per second and watching Will Smith limp around like an old man.
Are you saying that the difference between Will Smith 20 years ago and Will Smith now is that Will Smith 20 years ago makes this look good?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. He made it look good, and now he makes it look bad. But making it look bad in the context of Bad Boys for Life is good. That's the twist. This is really a big like TV movie. I kept thinking about all the times Jessica Fletcher came back to Murder, She Wrote over the years after it ended.
When are you thinking about that, though?
Shut up.
No, never.
Leave me alone.
Same thing you told me after Doolittle. You know, you're like, I keep thinking about all the times Jessica Fletcher started talking
was
to
talking
animals.
Was talking to the animals, yeah.
Whatever small Californian town she lived in.
Cabot Cove, and it was in Maine.
Oh,
I mean,
whatever.
It was filmed in
Maine is the California of the East Coast.
I mean, there's really not too much to say except for this is Grumpy Old Men. This is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. This is just two old guys bitching about growing up and then realizing it's a good idea to grow old and hand it off to the. I don't know if they are thinking this is going to be a spinoff series, but there is now a Advanced Miami Metro Operations, aka AMMO. Group that's like millennials using drones and hacking technology to do the same interrogations as Mike and Marcus did back in Bad Boys and Bad Boys 2. So they have the youngins to compete with. And I'm not sure, like, there's a Netflix series to be made about Ammo, I guess, that has Vanessa Hudgens running around.
Vanessa Hudgens, at, who's
that's actually fine.
Make a High School Musical joke.
She looks cool. I mean, all these guys, there's the hot guy from Riverdale's there, Alexander Ludwig. I don't know which character he played.
Listen, it's early. I mean, it's like January 19th or 20th when they were recording this, but Alexander Ludwig on my shortlist for best supporting actor for his role in this movie.
Yeah, he's a muscle man who had a bad time as being a bouncer, so he's suffering PTSD and only hacks. And then later in the movie, he's so strong he runs through a concrete pillar, but he does not beat people up because he does not like enacting violence. Oh, he was the grown-up son of Adam Sandler in Grown Ups 2. Or the blonde guy who was like, you know, everyone saw Grown Ups 2, right? He's in the
Grown Ups 3 is going to be his Norbit. I can see it coming already.
This is a hard movie to recommend to see at theaters, but definitely one to like watch at home or watch on a plane. It's Martin Lawrence gets so many funny lines. I don't know. Every time he's screaming in a car, I'm there for it. This is fun.
I mean, they have real chemistry. They are movie stars doing their thing. The action is not painful. It's not quite at the depth of The Irishman, but there is actual thought put into the story about aging out of their lives, about how their identities are connected to their jobs in ways that are really inextricable for one of the characters and not for the other. It opens with Martin Lawrence becoming a grandfather and the fallout just kind of cascades from there. It really...
Joe Pantoliano just screams and screams and screams like a madman. It's so great.
He really, really does. There's something about his performance that I guess I should not comment on before people see the movie. But and then it's fun in the third act to see the movie systematically undo all of the plot threads put into place in order to set up a Bad Boys 4. It's kind of impressive how it just reneges on everything. But and then the third act, I mean, all of the CG and all of the nonsense that they do a pretty good job of beating back for the first 90 minutes of the movie are just like a tidal wave comes in of crap. But
It's basically like Circus Musical if there was a Mexican witch.
but the character, I mean, and it leans into the idea of being plotted like a telenovela. I mean, it's very explicit about that and has some fun with that. And the supporting cast, to just double back to where we started, is so good in this movie that every aside that would cause you to roll your eyes in a lesser version of this movie just adds character to it.
Michael Bay appears as a wedding MC and has like a swirling camera angle around him.
It's early, but currently on my ballot for best cameo of the year. It's on there.
Will Smith beats up DJ Khaled, which I think we all wanted. That's fan service.
It's DJ Khaled who programmed the completely useless soundtrack to this movie. It is his only scene in the film, and he spends 95% of it getting the absolute shit kicked out of him by Will Smith, to the delight of people across America. That's what we want to see.
You all?
Rich folks who do nothing get handed to them.
Are you all running to see Bad Boys for Life?
I get why it's doing well. It sounds like fun and something that, you know, people know what they're getting into and they'll go see it. Why not?
There you go.
I've also never seen Bad Boys, so
Bad Boys good. Bad Boys 2, bad.
Bad Boys 2.
Oof, no. Gross.
It's great. They throw cars at them.
They do.
No, they throw corpses?
They do.
Bad Boys 2 is one of those rare films that actually earns the vulgar auteurism distinction.
Yes.
It is vulgar. It is auteuristic. It is 7.5 hours long. It looks like the most expensive piece of art ever created by humans. And I hear that if you lick the DVD, you just get pure cocaine residue on your tongue. It's wonderful. Like a man, not the yams, yams, yams. This is dead. Yes. Think again.
I'm a buff baby, but I dance like a man. She a nice lady and she shaking her yams. Spent the whole summer trapping out the sedan. Marching with the bands because I think that
so,
I can.
So we are entering the streaming wars. I don't know if y'all heard, but
we're in the streaming wars.
We found Star Piece. Now we need
that's true.
A new war.
We're into streaming wars. I guess we're in the streaming wars. We have Disney Plus now. We have Apple TV Plus, which is launching shows that I don't think people are watching. I don't know. Haven't checked in with the masses, but M. Night Shyamalan's
SAG are watching the morning show. That's
Jen
for sure.
Jen Ransom won a SAG award.
I didn't want to go in this direction with this conversation, but I will say that the morning show became a very good watchable show. Jennifer Aniston 100% deserves a SAG award and got it. And that's it. Reese Witherspoon is no one in this show.
In this age of streaming wars, when anyone tells me something became good, I'm like, nope. No time.
But here's the thing. Jennifer Aniston, perfect jumping off point to what I really want to talk about. So we have HBO Max coming out soon. We had Peacock, which had its big investor call and made lots of announcements this week that it's going to have like a free version for subscribers to actual cable and then maybe like a paid version, $5 a month if you want to watch 30 Rock all the time. So I think Katie's probably going to sign up for Peacock at some point.
I'm really – wait, are you saying that if I have cable, I can't get that? Because as one of the last idiots who pays for cable.
If you have cable, I think you're going to be good to get Peacock for free. So hang on. Hang on to your butts. But all of these services, especially HBO Max and Peacock, are paying out the wazoo for old sitcoms, which I find bizarre. You know, every time Friends – go back to Jennifer Aniston, changes platforms. It's news in our circles for some reason. And the reason is people are paying tons of money. HBO Max paid $425 million for 5 years of licensing Friends for when it launches in May. And it's been on Netflix forever. And it was a big deal because apparently, according to like Nielsen and these other viewership trackers that have to kind of infiltrate Netflix and get numbers since Netflix releases nothing, Friends and The Office were two of the most watched programs on Netflix streaming for like the past decade. So losing something like Friends seems like a big deal. And yeah, of course, $425 million is no joke. That's how much they're paying to get all the episodes of Friends, which people probably have watched all the time. All, you know, if you like Friends, you've seen it all. And then you have Peacock and NBC Universal paying $500 million for The Office, which you'd think they would own. But I guess someone else produced that, and it ran on NBC. And now they still have to buy the streaming rights back from The Office. That means huge deals for, like, Greg Daniels, the creator, and that sort of thing. And then later in the year, or last year, Big Bang Theory was – they didn't even have a price in the trade. So when HBO Max picked it up for a licensing deal, it was just in the billions, according to reports that Chuck Lorre was just – you know, money bin, Scrooge McDuck swimming in the billions that he was going to get
was,
for selling Big Bang
Theory.
It was
one bazinga's worth.
Bazingillion. It just amazes me that this amount of money is being spent on these huge – or on the I mean, they're big shows from 10 years ago, 20 years ago, sitcoms that go down real easy, but that no one is really producing – right now, not really, on at least on the main networks and not cable. This isn't the prestige television. This isn't the fodder of the streaming wars. And Netflix is investing in big shows like The Witcher. They're creating, I think, like $15 billion worth of content this year. And some of it is might be, you know, we just mentioned Sex Education. Maybe David can enlighten us. I still haven't watched it, and I don't know what it is. And I don't think it's like Friends. It's probably kind of a flashy, prestige drama that targets a very particular audience.
Sex Education?
Yeah.
Like a teen comedy.
Yeah. It's not Friends. It's not The Office.
It's a smart, modern, R-rated teen comedy, isn't it?
Exactly. I'll stop you there. It's smart. This is not what – well, I guess The Office you could applaud. I guess what I'm asking is like – am I missing something about the huge buys for these old school sitcom programs that are we producing these now? Or is anyone trying to make the next Office or the next Friends so that they have a property that's worth $500 million? Is it possible to do that in this era? Like, what is going on with the calculus here when everyone has already watched Friends? Everyone has already watched The Office. Is it because it's easy to put on and that is the real bread and butter of a new streaming service?
I mean, part of me thinks that this is the logical conclusion of the rush to just keep remaking things and reviving old properties is that you can just, you know, present in perpetuity the actual content that people are nostalgic for. And because our world is shit and people just want something mindless they can watch out of one eye when they look at their phone with the other, why not spend $1 billion on episodes of The Office? I think that that makes a certain amount of sense. And it is kind of this, like, tulip fever, everyone playing with fuck you money age, where
the Weinstein Company film tulip.
Mediocrity is, like, the greatest thing that you could invest in. I mean, if any of us were average enough to have created the Big Bang Theory, we would be rich right now. Many times over. But it is also, you know, go back to Sex Education, which is in its second season right now. Watching, getting invested in a Netflix show or any of these streaming shows now feels even riskier to me than it used to get invested in a network television show that was still airing, because the turnover rate is so extreme and Netflix has really started cutting shows off after three or four seasons, sometimes really without any warning. And because they're all just about bringing in new subscribers. And once a show has already brought in the audience it's going to bring, they need to cut their losses and move on to something that might keep people watching. And so it puts it in a perilous state. And when they hit upon something that's actually good and a story that might have legs for a few more years, you're not sure if you're going to be able to see them develop, which is why, I really, other than something like this, which is a really easy show to watch, I'll try to avoid these shows unless they get multi-year, deals like the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. I still haven't watched the third season, but you know, that show has been picked up for two seasons at a time, in big splashy press releases. The Crown has a certain, trajectory laid out for it already. So I know that I can invest in that. And also season 9 of The Crown is going to be fucking insane based upon what's happening right now.
They're not going to do it. They're a bunch of jerks.
I know. They're going to stop after like season 6. Lame. But then everyone in the same team can just go on and make something new and make like the ultimate Harry and Meghan companion miniseries or whatever. But yeah, it's wild times.
Dave took a long drag from his vape, so I'm curious about your opinion.
Oh, yes, it's my thinking vape. Yeah, it's like all these properties are the things, the like last vestiges that, of that type of comedy that were produced under that type of model. Like we might see a Modern Family pick up at some point when that show like ends. But that's kind of it in terms of that traditional sitcom. If you were going to like make it for a streaming property, that I think falls on more what David was talking about, where it's like they see it as like creating content to draw. This is more like buying the mortar that the old people, like the provable data says that people watch this, whether that be like Nielsen data or, you know, some sort of streaming promotional data to bump up the price. I think they're probably all overpriced, but I don't actually know the amounts of money we're talking about post-splintering. If they're all dealing with like Netflix amounts of money, then that's not really overpriced if you could, you know, parlay that into making a viable streaming platform for a decade. But if, you know, the Peacock becomes the place that you go for just The Office and their additional content doesn't work and ends up maybe cycling back to their broadcast network or disappearing into nowhere, then the Office is like, I don't know. Do you pay $5 for monthly access to The Office? There are probably some people who would.
I mean, we've been so positioned at this point to not even think of you owning anything. It's like you have to pay monthly access to whatever is the thing that you mm-hmm. want to watch. Like getting a show on DVD, or I guess you can get The Office on Blu-ray maybe. It just like no one thinks about it, even though it would be like, I mean, by far the more effective way to do it.
People don't have the technology to do that.
Oh,
I would
yeah,
say most of the young people in my life do not own Blu-ray players.
A lot of people DVD our age don't own Blu-ray yeah. players.
Let alone
TV. Well, they have like PlayStations or something, but like also yeah. like they don't even think about that in terms of access. Like I think there'll be a generation that doesn't even think about that because they want it streaming and they want to have like, you know, Billie Eilish like watches The Office like all the time, like 6 episodes a day or something. something I learned at some sort of weird profile.
So Billie Eilish is going to subscribe to Peacock.
Yeah, probably.
Wait, I thought HBO has The Office.
No, HBO has Friends and Big Bang, and then
got it.
Peacock will have The Office.
Well, that's the other thing, is that like the branding, like so much branding went into must-see TV and NBC Thursday nights, and like you associate The Office and 30 Rock and Friends with NBC like so closely, and now they're going to be split across all these different networks. No one is ever going to know where to find anything.
I mean, most people associate Friends and The Office with Netflix. That's what's peculiar.
That's true.
And that seems like what it seems like now. A coup, I guess. I don't know if that will piss people off, or if that feels like a coup. If that's competitive, it's like, oh, I will go follow the company that got The Office. How dare you take it away from Netflix? Now we're at war.
I don't know. I don't have that kind of brand loyalty. I mean, I remember when like HD DVD was up against the Blu-ray players. I really took a side. I mean, I was really like, I am team Blu-ray. I will always remember to the day I die the dumbest fucking article I've ever read on the internet, which was Harry Knowles writing in favor of HD DVD. I encourage you to go look it up. It is everything that film journalism should not be.
Everyone remembers this, obviously. This is a war that scarred us all.
I mean, I honestly am so deep into this shit, I can't tell if you're talking facetiously.
That HD DVD was a thing. That's
right. But like, this was a really formative article for me. I was already pretty entrenched in the Blu-ray side, mostly because
David loves Harry's Blade 2 review.
God.
Everyone should go read that and know that David loves that.
That is libel. But I was on Team Blu-ray player for very rational reasons, which is that it was Trojan horse into PlayStation 4 that I had already bought, or PlayStation 3, I guess it was at the time. PlayStation 3 had the Blu-ray player first. Who could remember? Yeah, because we're only on 4 now. That sort of mattered because it the outcome of that would depend on what I was able to watch in the future, and it wasn't as simple as just deciding to stop spending $9.99 on one service a month and start spending $9.99 on another. But now I don't really care. I want to just go where my comfort content is, so I sort of understand even why all of these like Gen Z kids are like, I just want to go where The Office is.
David wants to go to
The Office, like I watch Mad Men. But, for me right now, the show that I like to watch at the end of the day to relax is any of Anthony Bourdain's shows, which is sort of a double dilemma because, not only are they really sporadic across the because they're different, there's no reservations, there's parts unknown, there's the other one, and they're all scattered across the different streaming platforms, and then each of those streaming platforms only have a couple of seasons at a time. He's dead. So like it just feels different. Like there isn't a potential for a remake or reboot or new whatever. It feels like this one thing that's sort of being ping ponged between the different thing. I don't really know, but I do sympathize with how the teens are viewing, but there is, in this rush for content, it is funny the premium that has now been placed on content that already exists and everybody knows.
I guess that's my bigger point. Like, do we feel like any of the companies are trying to recreate the magic of these shows? Is anyone creating the next Office or the next Friends? Do you get that sense?
Well, the Kominsky method. We're already there.
What?
The Kominsky method, of course.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I emailed and said The Good Place.
Young Sheldon.
I didn't really mean The Good Place. I meant Schitt's Creek, which I've picked up again. I watched on maternity leave for a while. I've kind of jumped back into it. It is like famously was created as this big hit by being on Netflix. Netflix didn't make it, but when they started airing it, it kind of got to this place where it started getting nominated for Emmys. Its last season is airing now, so I think it's at 6. So it's not quite as long running as Friends or The Office. It's not going to have nearly as many episodes. But it's got that kind of like easily like return backable, like, Parks and Recreation vibe where like it can definitely be comfort television, which I think is part of why it broke out so big on Netflix. So I'd be curious about.
But that's the hilarious part. It's not a Netflix show, right? It's actually a Canadian show and it aired on Pop Network.
But Netflix also has The Ranch, which they keep renewing. So probably
that's about
a million people are watching.
Yeah, the ranch is done.
Oh, never mind.
You know, unrelated. No, you know what?
I live on forever too.
You know what I learned this week, thanks to a let's just say problematic Instagram caption written by Biju Phillips, was that Biju Phillips is married to Danny Masterson, who has his own problematic history. Star of the Ranch.
Are they both Scientologists?
Is that And he is the star, or was, I guess, the star of the ranch, along with Ashton Kutcher and Sam Shepard. Maybe we should all be watching The Ranch, or maybe not. You mean,
Sam Shepard.
You mean Sam Elliott.
Sam Shepard.
It's been a weird show since Sam Shepard died. I gotta admit. They're really pushing the envelope.
They still weekend with Bernie Simmons every episode.
It's incredible.
You gotta respect the commitment. It's just his.
Thank you, Henson Company.
Strange. He just believed in the writing of the ranch that much.
It's so pure. Yeah, I think it's Schitt's Creek is 100% worth kind of connecting the dots between The Office and that and the phenomenon of that show and just how it's been exalted in pop culture. But you can't deny the fact that it wasn't created by any of these streaming services. It's just been elevated by them. And then you have Pop Network trying to make their shows work and like kind of hoping, I guess, to get on Netflix. And yet one day at a time, might be the closest thing to this, or at least in terms of the conversation that it's created as a sitcom, and Netflix let it go, kicked it out the door. Now it's on Pop Network. I just think that's so funny. I wonder where it ends up streaming wise one day, but there's really just nothing. Well, no one's trying this game.
I mean, to a certain extent, the game's also like not the same game anymore, because sitcoms that you're talking about, they're meant to be endless because they need to get to 100 episodes, because that's used to be the syndication line, and that's when things would start paying off for people. So you have shows that are structured around providing familiarity, but also they have to get to that 100 episodes thing. Streaming alleviates the need for a syndication structure. So unless the thing has a following, it doesn't need to continue past this, certain point. And I'm not sure, like, The Good Place is structured to have a finite end, and that seems to be something that's working for it. And even though that's a TV sort of thing, I think that's going to bode well for it once it's all in the same place sometime in the future. But in terms of, like, shows that have started and, like, ended that way, my only, like, thought is, like, BoJack Horseman is technically a situation comedy.
Yeah.
It's been going for like multiple years and people seem to really like it. And it's going to, be able to end itself, which is used to be like our bellwether for a well-received sitcom that had passed the syndication rate. It didn't just disappear and get canceled. It got to end itself. So all these shows are like kind of rare, but they're rarer under an old system that doesn't exist. So not only do I not think we're going to get it again, but I kind of think it's going to be a while before we see someone try to ape it and like go for that nostalgia factor. I think like this sitcom's like a play on old sitcoms.
But it's not. What does the syndication number have to do with
the syndication?
That?
Like, does impact, because throwaway episodes experience and the role that syndication plays in being weaned on cable culture versus streaming is really important. Because for me, as someone who was raised on cable and still, like Katie, clutches onto cable with, and I will for dear life, even though it is like the same cost as my child's daycare is going to be at this point, is that like the soothing thing is finding the show online and watching it and seeing what's on TV and seeing what's available to me and watching that, rather than ferreting it out and picking it the same way that you would do on Netflix or Hulu or one of those. And so I'm not identifying with a company when I do that. I'm not picking a brand or making that kind of choice. I am adrift in this ocean of stuff, and it's all at the same price, and it's all available to me other than the movie channels that I can't afford. What's Shark Tank on CNBC is no different categorically for me than watching reruns of Catfish on MTV or whatever's playing on Turner Classic Movies or the new episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm where Larry David is using a MAGA hat to ward off people he doesn't want to talk to. What a coup. That's
so amazing.
This whole season is really going to be a balancing act, but that one particular joke is brilliant.
I got a little scared when he broke a selfie stick in the first season.
So I think it's like
off.
A different
– give it time.
It's a different relationship with the content. And syndication is kind of a safety blanket there. It's like it's saying to you, this is now part of your menu and this is available to you.
But the streaming services have
streaming
syndication.
Services do something that Shudder does, something that Turner Classic Movies Online used to do, which is always – and something the Criterion Channel really needs to do is have a channel – that whenever you log into the service, it is always playing something that you cannot choose or pause. Well, you could pause, I guess, if you wanted to, but certainly cannot choose. It is programmed, it is scheduled, and you watch it because it's there. And I think that would be, I really would like to see that marry the two worlds.
That's a good idea.
No, I mean, the technology exists.
It doesn't seem difficult.
But I would absolutely have watched The Witcher by now if every time I put on Netflix, they're like, here's The Witcher.
And you could, because The Witcher is kind of disposable and standalone.
Wait, isn't
that
happening?
Way.
Isn't that happening to you? If I don't navigate to
they just shout a trailer.
Netflix, like, no, say,
it's not a trailer.
Like talking to a monkey.
Yeah, it's a trailer.
Either way, I feel like I've already have watched chunks of The Witcher just by opening the app and not paying attention.
I get a lot of like children's programming that I don't want to ever watch, so I have to like navigate as quickly as possible away from the trailer so I don't get asked to watch that.
Especially if your kid's nearby, they might hear it.
I turn on Netflix for kids more than for myself, for sure.
So I guess sort of re-answer patches this question and loop back to syndication. It also changes like what type of story you're telling. So it used to be you had to find something that if you were beneficial enough to be played on TBS out of order, people still got like that comfort hit of, you know, four episodes of Home Improvement back to back, even though they weren't consecutive. And now you don't need to do that, which is nice because you can have things like The Good Place where you have to watch the first season first or you're never going to understand what the fuck's going on. Or, I do think it's something we can return to. It's just I don't think the audience is really interested in it. They want that nostalgia factor they don't have to pay attention to.
Can I ask you guys a closing question as like a lightning round? If you were raised on cable or Dick at Night like I was, like, was there a sitcom that was well before your time that you watched the way that Gen Z is now watching Friends?
I mean,
I Dream of Jeannie
Bunch,
and Bewitched.
Dream of Jeannie, Bewitched.
Dick at Night was my shit every weekday night at like 8 or 9 or whatever we would start.
Oh, yeah.
I Dream of Jeannie and Bewitched for sure.
Yeah. I watched a lot of Gilligan's Island. I think that was on TBS. Nice.
That was TBS like, mornings. That was like a summer. Waiting for camp to start show for me.
Yeah, I like that and like a lot of old game shows, which don't old like Press Your Luck. But Gilligan's Island, I think of specifically as something that was like so beyond my understanding that I just watched a ton of. And now I think I didn't know the math precisely, but Gilligan's Island was about as old for me as Friends is for teenagers now, which is terrifying.
Yeah. Have you subscribed to the Gilligan's Island streaming service?
I mean, if it's on Peacock, I'm there.
All you need is two coconuts and a little bit
Professor
at a time.
To jury rig it for you.
You're a monster.
I can swallow a bottle of alcohol in a...
That does it for this week's Friday in the War Room. As said, Patches and David are going to Sundance next week. So, Dave, we got the show to ourselves.
Yeah, maybe that like reviewer will like if it's that two-person show. Maybe like, Patches is the problem.
I feel like all the people who liked the one with you and Patches are not going to like the one with me. But we'll see.
Well, I'm very good at staying on topic if you bring the topics.
Well, in the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches, dragged across the podcast. And dragged across concrete. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. I work at Polygon. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, share them with your friends, who, you know, they should be listening. We need more friends listening to this show. And also you can comment on the episodes. If you have a thought and you don't have a social media platform, you go in the comments. I commented on the last week's episode. I didn't see anyone else there, but I commented.
It's me, right? I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the very tired senior critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find me in my apartment narrowly dodging baby shit.
What?
Right at me. No, I mean, I was about to go into a whole
saga. Can't dodge
saga.
It forever.
It's like, it's...
What color
more
is
often
that
than,
now?
It's not dark?
Black,
it's not
dark anymore. Black?
It, more often than not, is like a curry green. And it's always slightly alarming. And one night, it inspired me to get pesto for dinner, and I had no problem cordoning the two off in my brain. And the puke is still always white, which is really nice. And will continue to be until he starts eating solid foods. You can find all of us talking about baby poop on Fighting in the War Room, and you can please leave us a review, about anything you want about my baby's poop, I don't know, whatever's on your mind, at Fighting the War Room on iTunes. Please. Bye-bye. Movie Poop Shoot, a real website.
Movie Poop Shoot.
Movie Poop Shoot. I'm Dave Gonzalez. I spell my first name D-A-7-E. That is also my Twitter handle. You could find me tweeting there about things. And then also on The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast. We are in season 2 of Lost. It is fun to watch streaming television week to week, and especially rewatch something. We didn't talk about Lost, but it's on Hulu. All of it, we're watching it week to week. The Storm, Lost rewatch podcast. Check it out on your podcast app.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com, where I watch the SAG Awards. You all should have been there. And over there on the Gold Man podcast, where we're talking about award season for a few more weeks. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where I want to hear more about the sitcoms you watched as a child that were way before your time and you liked anyway. Or you can also answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of the gentleman and the new Batman movie filming, what do you wish next for Colin Farrell?
Actually, I take it back. I want that answer really bad, too. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
I'm done. We're done.